This evening, we're very fortunate to have one of our own Dallas Philosophers Forum board members to speak to us with a very impressive background, which I'll tell you a little bit about here. Dr. Lawrence Bochy left his home country, Ghana, for Italy to pursue his academic work in 1993. He obtained his doctorate degree with magna cum laude from the University of the Holy Cross in Rome in 2007, specializing in ethics and human science. Lawrence taught about a year in Rome before moving to Dallas in 2008. And since that time, he has been researching and writing and has published, it's incredible, three books in those two-year stretch titled A Contemporary Thomistic Approach of Peace Building, The Quest for Peace in Ancient Philosophy, and Educating the Person, Classic Concepts and New Perspectives. Dr. Lawrence also does private tutoring in his spare time in logic, metaphysics, ethics, and Italian. So maybe you want to see him about that after the talk. So without further ado, I give you Dr. Lawrence.
Yes, I was told that in Dallas, we speak slowly. So I'll try as much as I can to speak slowly. Yeah. If you don't hear me tell you, I'll just lift up my voice a little bit. So tonight is going to be, we're going to talk about Nicomachean ethics. And the whole concept of this book, written by Aristotle, at the end of the day, he was trying to make a point, and that is, what is happiness, and how can we attain happiness? So I'm going to make, you know, I'm just going to read and explain. Then at the end, this is not my idea, this is Aristotle, so I will just, so don't query me for anything. You can just make contributions, and what is right and what is wrong, it's okay, but that is what I say from my point of view. So I'm going to give a short, brief history of his life and his works, and we continue from there. So Aristotle was born in 384 BC in Greek town called Stagira. When he was just a boy of 10 years old, Aristotle's father died and he was taken under the care of a man named Proxenus. Proxenus sent Aristotle at the age of 17 to Athens, which was then the intellectual center of the world. Look at the next slide, please. So that is a map of, you know, ancient Greece, and you see Stagira up there, very close to Chalcedon, and you'll see the Lydia and Athens down right down below Euboea. Euboea will be the place where you finally go, retire, and that is where he died eventually. So that is a map, the ancient Greece map. That is how it looks like. So when he went to Athens, you know, and he joined the famed Plato's Academy, and he became a very prominent figure in Plato's Academy. And then, when Plato died in 347 BC, it wasn't Aristotle that took his place, even though he was intellectually capable. Plato's nephew, called Sisyphus, was chosen to head the Academy, because Aristotle's ideas has diverged too far from Plato. So this is the school of Athens. And this was painted by a man called Raphael Santi. And I worked in Rome in the Vatican Museum for 3 years when I was a student. And this painting is found in the Stanza di Sennatura, which is a beautiful room that was personal library of Pope Julius II, who reigned from 1503 to 1513. So this painting was where it was talking about, in those days, about knowledge, ancient Greece knowledge. And you can see in this painting, Raphael was able to depict all kinds of scientists and philosophers. So you can see Heraclitus, you can see Parmenides, you can see Zarathustra. All of those guys has been depicted in this painting. And that was the impression I wanted to just have at the back of your mind, that it was so elegant in that time. Knowledge, studies, the pursuance of knowledge was so important. And that is how it looked like at that time. And you go to the next slide, you see Plato and Aristotle. And this is where they began to have their different perspectives. And that is why when Plato died, Aristotle didn't have a chance. Because if you look at this painting, just the enlarged or the other one, you can see Aristotle was holding his hand down, and Plato was holding his hand up. And holding his hand down is talking about concreteness, talking about being pragmatic, being going through experiences to draw a conclusion about truth. And you can see Plato holding his hands up, showing, you know, forms, ideas are out there, you know. So that is where they really, you know, the beginning of their separation. And even you can see that the colors, you can see Aristotle is wearing that kind of blue and brown, which represent water and the earth, something really substantial of this place. And the other side, you see those two colors of Plato represents air and fire. That's what they talk about. That was representing something of beyond. So that is where these two people really, you know, went their separate ways. That is why Aristotle couldn't become the real person who was supposed to take care of the Plato's academy. So when Plato's nephew, Sisyphus, became the head of the academy, Plato left the academy for another court of Athenaeus in Mysia. Here, he stayed for 3 years, where he married his first wife, Pythias, the king's niece. After 3 years in the Persians invaded Athenaeus, you know, killing Aristotle's friend Aeneas, who was the ruler at that time. So he moved to a place called Mytilene at the invitation of Philip of Macedonia and tutored his 13-year-old son, Alexander the Great, for a long time. When Philip died, Alexander took the throne, and Aristotle at that time left for Athens. Here in Athens, Aristotle set up his own school called the Lyceum. And for 13 years, he taught his followers his philosophy and ideas until 323 BC, when he was forced to flee to Euboea, where he died in 322 BC. So that is a little bit about his history. Now about his words. Aristotle wrote a number of works which themselves have interesting history. When Aristotle died, they were kept by one of his students called Theophrastus, who also took over the school when Aristotle was forced to leave Athens. This extensive library of philosophical works was then handed down to Theophrastus' student called Nellius. Nellius and his people also concealed this work in the vault to protect them from theft, where subsequently partially was ruined by darkness as well as mud. So in 100 BC, they were discovered by Pelican, who was a Greek lover, who took them to Athens, and they later on was taken to Rome after Athens was captured in 86 BC. Here, Aristotle's works took the interest of the Roman scholars, and this gave a fresh drive to the study of Aristotle. So Aristotle's works comes under this kind of five categories. We have the first part called Categoria, which is categories, where he writes on interpretation, pure prior analytics and posterior analytics topics, and all kinds of ideas. Then you go on to his Physica, or the Physis, where he writes on generation and corruption of the soul, and animals, and movements of animals, and all kinds of things. Then the third part of it, he talks about Metaphysica, you know, who deals with first philosophy. That's what he tends to call and calls it. Then where we are going to be much more focused on is the Ethica Nicomachea, or Nicomachean Ethics. In the ethics area, he also wrote the Minor Moralia, which is the great ethics, and also the Ethica Eudaimonia, Eudaimonian ethics, and politics. So this, of course, belongs to the practical philosophy, where it's concerned with doing, acting, and living in the world. Then the latter part of it is called the Rhetorica, or Rhetoric, or De Arte Poetica, which is the poets. Poem that he wrote, the poetics, what he wrote about that as well. And these deal with production rather than action. So these are the five categories of his works which we are going to be about Aristotle. But our main interest is going to be the Nicomachean Ethics and partly the Eudaimonian Ethics. You know, the title, Ethica Nicomachea and Ethica Eudaimonia, reflect a tradition. That the name Nicomachea refers to Nicomachus, was a son of Aristotle, who became the man who edited Aristotle's lectures. There's a bit, some say, his father was called Nicomachus. So when Aristotle gave birth to his son, he gave the name Nicomachus to his son. And when he wrote the book, he named it because the son was the one who who edited Aristotle's lectures in his museum. You know. And Eudemian refers to Eudemus, who was also known as a member of Aristotle's Institute, the Lyceum. So he named, these books were named after these people, and that is how it became known as Ethica Nicomachea. In any case, these two works cover more or less the same ground with a lot of similarities. The manuscript of books 5 and 8 of the Nicomachean Ethics are known to be the same as book 4 and 6 of the Eudemian Ethics. However, the manuscripts of the Nicomachean Ethics does not give any information why this kind of, you know, overlapping. They don't talk about it, but we know that Eudemian Ethics was written before the Nicomachean Ethics. So there's maybe the probability that it just kind of pasted or whatever. Nobody knows. It's not well explained. So that is the background of the Nicomachean Ethics. You know. So I want to give a brief exposition here. Can I go to the next slide? Yeah. So the Nicomachean Ethics was written around 350 BC, and this is known as Aristotle's one of his most well-known works in ethics. The English version of the title derives from the Greek word known as Ethica Nicomachea, or which is sometimes given the genitive form as Ethicon Nicomachon, you know, in the Latin, which is also commonly used as Ethica Nicomachea. So that is the name that has been given over the Greek, the English, and the Latin name as well. The Nicomachean Ethics is widely considered as one of the most important historical and philosophical works, and had an important impact on the European medieval ages, becoming the core of medieval philosophy. It therefore indirectly became critical in the development of all modern philosophy as well as European law and theology. In the Middle Ages, a synthesis between Aristotelian ethics and Christian theology became widespread, especially in Europe. The most important version of this synthesis was that of St. Thomas Aquinas. Aristotle's, you know, original work has once again become an important source. And most recent authors influenced by his works are Ayn Rand, Alasdair MacIntyre, Hans Georg Gadamer, Martin Nussbaum, and many other more. So this is how, up to today, Aristotle's concept is so influential. You know, you can never talk about any argument in ethics without coming across something that was said by Aristotle. So let's go to the next slide, please. And this is just an outline that I made for the books. All the books are in 10 chapters, but some of the chapters, it's made in 10 books, and you have different chapters. Some of the chapters overlap, you know. So like book 1, you have from 1 to 13, it talks about happiness. Then in book 1, chapter 13, alone, it talks about what happiness requires, which is the virtue of character. In book 2, chapter 1 to 9, it talks about virtuous character, the states of human beings that secure their happiness. In the same book 3, chapter 1 to 5, it talks about preconditions of virtues, voluntary action and responsibility. In the same book 3, chapter 6, to book 5, chapter 2, talks about individual virtuous characters as well. Then book 6, chapter 1 to 13, talks about virtues of thought. Book 7, chapter 1 to 10, incontinence and other related topics as well. Then book 7, chapter 1 to, you know, chapter 11 to 14 talks about pleasure. Then book 8 to book 9 talks about friendship. Book 10, chapter 1 to 5 about pleasure. Book 10, chapter 6 to 8 about happiness and charitable studies. Then the final chapter talks about ethics, moral education, and politics. So that is more or less a kind of a summary about the whole stuff about Aristotle. So I'm going to move on right away to talk about what is in the Nicomachean Ethics. So according to Aristotle, the best way to study controversial subjects as ethics or politics, which involve the discussion about what is true, beautiful and just, is to start with what will be roughly agreed to by people of good upbringing, you know, and experience in life, and to work from there to a higher understanding. So Aristotle uses the same approach to address the subject concerning highest good for human beings. You know, so he begins this Nicomachean Ethics talking about you can't just get up and start making assumptions about life. For him, it is very important to listen, to observe what is going on around him, to be able to understand what is going on in the society, you know, to live your life and just experience life in itself. Then when you get this information, then you can put it together to make an assumption, to make a point. So he believed so much in experience, and right from book one, he talks about this importance, that you can never make an assumption, you can never make a conclusion, or you can never talk about anything without having some prior experience or something that has already been going on in the society. So before you make this kind of, you know, assumptions or whatever, like your presumptions or analysis, make sure you collect data from the society. Listen to what people are saying. Look at what people are going through. And when you have these ideas, then you can put them together to make a conclusion about something. So by saying that, he's saying that if you want to talk about happiness or the common good or the highest good of human beings, we must use the same kind of procedure. It's a kind of methodology, which is so different from Plato and before that time. So that he comes along with so much different approach about learning about the truth, what is beauty and what is truth. So to be able to, you know, show what is truth, he goes on, or to determine the highest good or happiness for mankind, we will need to begin to examine primitive ideas or those ideas that seem to be arguable and known to us. To know the highest good, we will have to base our argument on practical inquiry, thus examining carefully the general, at the same time, conflicting affirmations circulating in the society. So he then begins his argument by making his first assertion, that is talking about what is the good and what is happiness. And he says that the highest aim or the highest thing that all human beings are looking for is called eudaimonia. He makes that statement that every human being is looking for eudaimonia. And eudaimonia is happiness. And he calls it the highest good as well. So he says whatever we are doing, the main intention of our life as human beings is we are looking for happiness. No matter what you do, you could be looking for something, you'll be looking for something in your life, your focus on something very different or something very particular. But what he's trying to say is that indirectly, we are looking for happiness, you know. So he says that because of this, that we are looking for happiness, he begins to say that, then what do we have to do? To know this thing, we have to be able to understand what this happiness is all about. You know, so he translates the word happiness to mean the well-being, eudaimonia, is well-being or self-sufficiency, or the word happiness I've said, you know. So this Greek word, eudaimonia, is composed of two sides, two aspects. The first part is called eu, which means well-being, and daimon also means divinity. So in the ancient philosophy, in the ancient times, when somebody says you are enjoying eudaimonia, it means that you have been favored by the gods. But for Aristotle, the things, eudaimonia just means happiness. You know? So he doesn't go by the traditional meaning of that word. That is how it goes. You know? So in his book, he begins to discuss this prevailing and fundamental question of happiness, which he thinks is the highest good. So let's go to the next slide, please. Yeah? And over here, he talks about, he makes his first acclamation. And I read in Greek, say that, Passa technikai, passa metodos, omoios, the praxis, the kai, proeresis, agato, todos, afiestai, docei, dio, kalos, apophenanto, thalaton, opa, afiestai, which means that every act and every inquiry, and similarly, every action and pursuit is thought to aim at some good. And for this reason, the good has already been declared to be that at which all things aim. See. But over here, he goes on to talk about the fact that there are certain differences, like everything is acting, we are all moving towards this good. But this good is found in different ways, in different people. We are all looking for this end, but people look at it from all different angles, you know. Some of this way of looking for this good is activities, always come from our products, apart from the activity that they produce them. And he says that where there are ends, apart from the action, it is the nature of the product to be better than the activities itself. Now, as there are many actions, as there are many arts and science, their ends are also many. You see, the end of the medical art, he says, is health. That of shipbuilding, a vessel, and that of strategy is victory. Yes, sir. And that of economics is wealth. So he was saying that even though we are all moving towards this good, but everybody, people are looking for it from different angles, you know. And he says that because they're looking for it from different angles, for example, those who are looking for the good in medicine is to attain health. Those who are looking for the good in shipbuilding is to come out with the boat. Those who are looking for the good in the strategy is to come out with victory and war. And what about the economy is to give us wealth. So he said that all these things are good, but all these goods that we are talking about come out with different kinds of an end, which means that these ends, according to him, he's going to continue to talk about it, does not really become the ultimate end. You know? So he goes on to talk about the next thing he says here over here. He says that, Osai the Elcides Tauton, Upo Mian Tina Dinomi, Katape Upo Den Ipikan Kalinopoli, Kai Osai Alaiton Ipikon, Organ Els in Auto Dikai Pasapolimiki Pa Praxis, Upo Den Strategiken, Kataton Auton Ditropon, Alai of Etheras in Apoesis, Vitabes Architectonicon, Telebraton Astin Iret, Taraton Uto Auta, Toto Agar Kirin, Kakaina Diotika, which means that, but when said arts fall under a single capacity, as bridle making and other arts concerned with the equipment of horses fall under the art of riding, and this and every military action and the strategy, in the same way other arts fall under yet others. In all these, the ends of the master arts are to be preferred to the subordinate ends, for it is for the sake of this former that the latter is pursued. So he begins to talk about this kind of, you know, even though we are looking for different kinds of ends and whatever we are looking for, but at the same time, there are some ends which are much more important than the other ends. So he begins to build this kind of a pyramid gradually, you know. For example, somebody gets money, but money is not an end itself. Money will help you to get your mortgage or to buy a car. So you get that. Car will take you to some places, it helps you in something else. So whatever you use your car to achieve in life, that becomes the next good in your life. So he was talking about the importance of knowing these ends. But at the same time too, there is something higher than that. So the good that we think makes you happy, it doesn't end there. You look for that good, but when you get that good, that happiness, there is something else to be looking for. So you keep on going on, and on, and on, and on. And that is why people are not happy these days. Because it's endless. It goes on and on and on. So Aristotle begins to build this pyramid of what is the good, you know. And he goes on to the next slide, which he says, I think that's okay, the greatest good, yeah. Which he says, I'm not going to read the Greek anymore, it's just taking too much time. He says that, if then there is some aim of things we do, you know, which we desire for its own sake, everything else being desired for the sake of this. And if we not choose everything for the sake of something else, for at that rate, the process will go on to infinity. So that our desire will be empty and vain. Then this must be the good and the cheap good. So if we avoid going on and on and on and find that particular good that we are looking for, which is the highest good, then we will never end looking for something in our lives. So because of that, we have to find the ultimate good. And we have to find it, and it should become our point, so that we can move towards that without really, you know, moving on and on and on, looking for something else in our lives. So he goes on, I'll read from here, and say that, if there is some end of thing that we do, which we desire for its own sake, and everything that's being desired for the sake of this, and if we do not choose everything for the sake of anything else, clearly this must be the good and the greatest good. And he says, Will not the knowledge of this good then have a great influence on our lives? Shall we not, like archers, you know, who have a mark to aim at, be more likely to hit upon what is right? If so, we must try, in outline at least, to determine what it is, and of which of the sciences or capacities it is the subject. It will seem to belong to the most authoritative art, and that which is most truly the master art of all. But he goes on to say, however, unfortunately, in trying to discover this highest good, or the eudaimonia, or the happiness, many of us seem to misconceive what the good or the happiness really is. Many believe it is mere pleasure and gratification. Thus, by believing in this way of life, we become slavish in this concept of happiness. Relating to pleasure is completely, according to Aristotle, to the life of the grazing animal. So he's trying to say that in trying to find the good, sometimes we get to a certain level and we get stuck there because we think that is cool. I mean, I want money, I want money. So we get stuck there thinking that that is the highest good. And that is what is the conception that people think that when you get to some level, but after a couple of years or maybe of a moment in time, you begin to look for something else. You know. So what he's trying to say is that when you get to those levels where you think you are happy, don't think you have come to the end of it all. Because eventually you will look for something else in life. Therefore, he was trying to say when, especially in pleasure, in gratification, he thinks that many people get stuck in this particular area. That is why he says, he makes this point here that if you make yourself get stuck in this area, eventually you become like an animal. Because in that particular circumstances, you will never be able to be happy. You will be able to be craving for more of or more of that same thing without moving on. You know. So let's go to the next year. So this is where I made a kind of chart, the greatest good. And down here you see different kinds of goods. Then as it goes up, the goods get limited. And you get to that point, there is a line where maybe you may get stuck there because it's money, it's pleasure, whatever you're looking for, gratification. And when you get there, you get stuck. And when you get stuck and you don't really move on, it makes you really become more or less, for him, useless. It doesn't make sense. Therefore, from there to the next major problem, which is the highest and the greatest good, becomes what most people can't really make it out of it all. You know. So over here, for example, he makes a very interesting analogy by saying that the masses of mankind that eventually become slavish in this taste of pleasure and gratification, preferring a life which is suitable to animals or to beasts, but they get some ground for their view. What he's trying to say is that when they get to this level of happiness, which is the normal concept of today, he uses the word that it's been confirmed. He used the name Salinopolis. It's a man. Let me go to the next slide, please. He used the name of a man. He said that now the mass of mankind are even quite slavery in their face, preferring a life suitable to beast. But they get some ground for their view from the fact that many of those in places share the taste of Salinopolis. Salinopolis was a very interesting person. He was a hedonist and a licentious kind of a Syrian king. And he lived a life very vulgar in that time, you know. And he was the last of 10 kings in that time of his reign. And he was like, never cared about anything, just enjoying life. And because of him, Assyria came to a downfall. And what he's trying to say is that people like Salinopolis was one of the people who affirmed that pleasure or gratification is okay. That is the highest good. So in modern life also, you see people trying to affirm certain ways of life, defining them as the real happiness of life. But he's saying, don't listen to these kind of authorities because it is not true. There is something more than just this affirmation of pleasure and gratification. You know? So, if these things are not happiness, Aristotle goes on to say, well, what is this ultimate happiness that we're talking about? Or the ultimate good that we're talking about? Aristotle continues to explain that maybe happiness, he begins to explore here. You know? He says, maybe happiness can be found with a cultivated person. that's a person who is active in politics, because such a person conceives the good as honor. Since it is more or less the end normally pursued in the political life. But Aristotle realizes that pursuing politics cannot be the sole ultimate end for man. So he moves on to analyze honor. But on a second thought, Aristotle realizes that the attainment for honor can be superficial, since it will not depend more on those who give the honor than those who are honored. You know. And he moves on to say that, then what about virtue? You know. He says that virtue in itself is also incomplete, you know, because it is possible for someone to possess virtue but be asleep or inactive throughout his life. You know, or maybe possess virtue but the person may suffer worse evils and misfortunes in life. If someone leads such an abnormal life, it will be difficult to count or identify happiness in such a person. So Aristotle then talks about the pursuit for money, and in this case also he rebounds it by stating money cannot be the ultimate good and happiness for mankind. Yeah. And over here he talks about the life of money making is undertaken under compulsion, and wealth is evidently not the good that we are seeking, for it is merely useful and for the sake of something else. And so one might rather take the fourth named object to be the end, for it is love for itself. But it's evident that not even this is the end that we are looking for. So Aristotle believes that there is some sort of good and happiness in everything that we are looking for in our lives. But the forms of good and happiness we obtain seem different in different acts and actions. For it's for this sake that all men do whatever else they do, since there is evidently more than one end, and we choose some of these for the sake of something else, clearly not all ends are found out. But the chief good is evident, or the highest good is evidently something which is final. Therefore, if there is one final end, this end is what we must be looking for. This end is what we are seeking. And if there is more than one, the most final is the one that we must seek in our lives. For this reason, ethics is not and can never be a theoretical discipline, because if ethics is what we are going to use to really determine the highest good, then it's not something of a theory. It has to be something practical, because it has to deal with actions. And that is the only way we can determine the true definition of happiness. But because we will better able to achieve our good, we develop a further understanding of what we flourish. In raising this question, what is good, Aristotle is not looking for a list of items that are good. He assumed that such a list can be compiled rather easily. Most will agree, for example, that it is good to have friends, to experience pleasure, to be healthy, to be honored, to have such virtues as courage, at least some degree. The difficult and controversial question arises when we ask whether these goods are more desirable than others. Aristotle's search is a search for the highest good, and he assumes that the highest good, whatever it turns out to be, must have three characteristics. One, it is desirable for itself. It is not desirable for the sake of some other goods, and all other goods are desirable for its sake. Yes. The next slide, please. So that is how he thinks of this, you know, that this highest good that we're talking about must have these conditions, you know, must be something specifically human, must be some kind of individual, must achieve by its own achievements, must be an activity which improves interaction in the world, must be something that is self-sufficient, you know, and must be perfect, final and complete. Now, we call what is in itself where you perceive more final than that which is where of pursuit for the sake of something else. And that which is never desirable for the sake of something else must find out that the things that are desirable both in themselves and for the sake of other things. And therefore we call find out without qualification that which is always desirable in itself and never for the sake of others. Now such a thing is happiness above all else. It's held to be. For this we choose always for self and never for the sake of something else. Honor, pleasure, reason, every virtue we choose indeed for themselves, but we choose them also for the sake of happiness. judging that by means of them we shall be happy. So for true happiness, on the other hand, no one chooses for the sake of this. In general, everything is being chosen for the sake of this particular thing. So it goes on and on, and that is how he begins to define what is happiness. So he says that happiness that we are talking about is also what he called the self-sufficiency. And what is self-sufficiency for him? He defines it as what he called autarkeia. You know, so happiness in itself is a self-sufficiency. So the whole thing he's talking about is that as we move on looking for this happiness, we will come across all different kinds of planes of pleasure, of gratification, of self-gratification ourselves. But these things are not what we are really looking for. And we have to keep on moving on until we get to a level whereby you come to this state, and what you have over there is what is the right thing. And we call this state the self-sufficiency. The name he gives it is called autarkeia. And he defines it as, even when man is in isolation, his life is lacking nothing. And when you get to this particular situation, that is for him, you are happy. So now, after defining all these things, which is so difficult to define in Aristotle, he comes down from book 2 onwards to give us the different kinds or the strategies, the ways that we have to lead our lives to be able to get into happiness. So he talks about 1, the human function; 2, the doctrine of the mean; 3, he talks about practical reason; 4, he talks about acquisition of intellectual virtues; external factors, character traits, and desire. And these are the things for him that every human being must inculcate in his life or in her life. And these are the instruments, I call it the contingent factors, that for Aristotle can make you arrive at that happiness. So you realize that in the first book, it's very complicated. The way he writes it, he goes up and down. He goes back and forth, redefining and defining. And he goes up and so when you read the first book, it can really confuse you a lot. You know, but all that he's trying to say so far is that this happiness that you're talking about, it can be attainable. It's attainable. But you have to go through this kind of stages to be able to get there. So what are these stages? The first one he talks about is what he called the human function argument. You know, and over here, it is called in Greek the ergon. You know, and in the ergon, he says, Aristotle admits that this concept of eudaimonia that we are talking about, it's not all that realistic without some further attempt to define more closely what the concept means. In other words, the concept is, to this point, rather empty of significant content. Aristotle means this need with another traditional Greek notion, and this is what he talks about, that so far all that we have been talking about is just empty. The way to get to this happiness is all theoretical. But from now, from book 2 onwards, he begins to give all these factors that will make this concept of happiness something that you can really, you know, can be attainable. You know. So over here he talks about the argument, which talks about the human function, which rests on the assumption that everything which is living or dead has a specific function for which it is designed. In the same way too, to attain human excellence, which eventually will lead you to happiness, will therefore depend upon the extent to which the person fulfills the function which he is designed to do. For example, a knife which cuts poorly will have little excellence, since it carries out this function very poorly. A race horse which runs fast will have high excellence, and he calls it director, since it is fulfilling its function very well. Since a human being is, above all, a social and political being, then the excellence of a human being will be those things which best enable the human being to fulfill that social and political functions. Now, since this excellence of anything is particular to that thing, Aristotle seeks what the unique function of a human being must be. He identifies the unique function of a human being as a rational element in action. And he quotes, "The proper function of man then consists in an activity of the soul in conformity with a rational principle, or at least not without it. This human excellence depends upon the extent to which this unique function manifests itself. This function of the soul, or this human function, relates to a special kind of life or activity, an action for the soul, which involves the reason. If this is so, then the person is able to act well based on reason. Then he is acting as an excellent man who does well on the way towards highest good. So the function of the soul, according to Aristotle, is the reason. And this is the one important factor, that you can never achieve happiness without applying to the reason. That is what he calls the activity of the soul. The reason backed by your function, what you are being created to do as a human being. So like you realize that this concept even comes from Plato a little bit, talking about specialization. You read Republic of Plato, talks about every human being has something that he's born to do. So according to Aristotle, the first thing that can make you happy is to find what your function is supposed to be. That is number one. And when you find your function and you act in that function with your reason, then you are on the right path. If you don't know what you are born to do, if you don't know what you are good at, your inclinations, your man-made qualities, then it's going to be difficult. That's what he's saying. That's what he calls the human function. So Aristotle implies here that the pursuit of goodness and happiness is solely a thing of human beings. Therefore, nobody can achieve. I mean, if it's based on reason and our function of soul, then animals, for example, can never be happy. Because happiness is only given to mankind. Because it's only man who can reason. So this, for if you realize that in his philosophy, these ideas will come on and on and on every now and then. The concept of the reason being number one factor in the way that we can be happy. And knowing who you are, knowing what you are born to do. For him, that is very, very important. So he says that if we use our reason well, we live well as human beings. Or to be more precise, using your reason well over the course of a full life is what happiness consists of. Doing anything well requires the virtue of your excellence. And therefore, living well consists in activities caused by the rational soul in accordance with virtue. And as he states, and as in the Olympic Games, it is not the most beautiful and the strongest that are crowned by those who compete, so those who act will win. Those who act and act well will win the noble and the good things in life. So you don't have to be nice, you don't have to be beautiful, thinking that that can lead you to happiness. But you need to act. You need to be here on this planet. You need to live your life. You need to use your mind. You need to use your given capabilities and your potentialities in life. And if you're able to combine these things together, then you are on the right track to happiness. So he goes on to say that when man acts in accordance with reason, he encounters pleasure in himself. You see? And when man encounters pleasure in what he does not need extra pleasure of happiness to be added to himself. Aristotle's concept about happiness is, in a sense, uniquely his own. No other writer or thinker has said precisely what he says about it, how to live well in his concept of happiness. But at the same time, his view is not too distant from common ideas as well. He says that not that happiness is virtue, but that it's a virtuous activity, whereby one, identify who you are, your potentialities, act, but act with your reason power. If you combine these things, then that makes you a person who lives well. And he says, yeah, I like the way he says it. He says that living well consists in doing something, not just being in a certain state of condition. And that is the sort of the popular definition of a happiness, being the state where you gotta be. That kind of state, you know. For him, it's not that way. You have to act. It's an activity which goes on and on and on. It consists in those lifelong activities that actualizes the virtues of the rational part of the soul. So apart from this, Aristotle further adds that, no, that's okay, you live in the air, yeah. Aristotle further adds that in order to be happy, one must possess other goods as well. He says, okay, you gotta be happy, but that doesn't only depend on your reason and your rational soul and your function, but you also need certain things in life. And these are some of the things he talks about, you know, pleasure, good health, appearance, you know, proper nourishment and sustenance, full lifespan, some sort of good fortune, respectable family origin, friendship, and so all those things for them are just instrumental factors, you know. So for him, if one lacks these things, then it's like, yeah, this is just a kind of somebody with an external stimuli, you know. If one lacks these sort of things, even though you could be there doing your own thing right, you could be acting very well, you could be doing your acting with your reason power, trying to be on the right track, but you need these external factors, you know. You need, over here he says that someone who is friendless, childless, powerless, weak, and even ugly, he says they can really prevent you from really becoming real happy. That's like this. And that's somebody like Ogden, you know, this such a person, you know, it becomes so difficult, you know, this is my uncle, don't laugh, you know, so that's true. he thinks, you know, if you lack these things in life, it doesn't really help you so much. Therefore, even though you should be happy, you should pursue happiness, having your functions, having your reason, but you need these external factors. So you realize that what we think, what the culture thinks that will make you happy, for our rest of it, they are just instrumental factors. Like wealth, having a family, because some of us will die for having kids. Some of us will die for getting some positions in life. Some of us will die for buying a particular kind of house. And they'll put all their life in that direction, thinking that that's going to keep them happy. But according to our rest of it, these factors are just external. They are not the real deal. They are just there to help you. And he says that these things can help you, but at the same time too, that is not a real thing. We are just external stimuli, you know. So he goes on to say that happiness and virtuous activities is something, it's not something that comes to us by chance also. Apart from these external factors, although we must be fortunate enough to have parents and fellow citizens who help us become virtuous and make us happy, we ourselves share much of the responsibility for acquiring and exercising virtuous life and the ultimate good and happiness. Therefore, happiness is acquired through learning, habituation, and even in cultivation. It is, as Aristotle repeats again here, an activity of the soul in agreement with virtue. Anything apart from this is merely instrumental. It is also for this reason that in the initial stages of the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle comments on political science as part of the highest good, because the function of good politics is to form the character of the citizens, directing them to the path of virtue and goodness and efficient happiness. So like, also you can see that like in the political world, the politics is so very important. That can help the people to live a good life as well. So happiness also, apart from all these things, he says that happiness must be a lifelong achievement. And it has to comprise, and it requires complete virtue and complete life. However, we must understand that a complete life also includes many reversals of fortune, and good or bad, with good fortune or bad fortune. And anybody can fall into this kind of terrible suffering in life as well. Therefore, happiness can only be attributed to a person when he dies. That's why he says afterwards, you know, he goes and says, oh, I think then nobody can be happy until the person dies and goes away. Because he thinks that when somebody goes into this kind of fluctuation, sometimes you are happy, sometimes you are not happy. Therefore, when you live this life, it is not possible to be called happy man. It is unless when you die that they can say that you are happy. Because when you fluctuate in your happiness, that doesn't make you authentically a very happy person. Therefore, in this part of the book, he doesn't really explain it very well by saying that, okay, if this is not right, if we cannot have somebody who could be happy throughout his own life, then the only way we can really say that somebody is happy is when the person dies. But he said, well, that is a fact, but it doesn't mean that we can just stop them. So he goes and says that, therefore, you know, the reason why Aristotle makes this assertion is that the state of real happiness must not fluctuate. And he says in Book 1, Chapter 10, that we must suppose that happiness is enduring and something is definitely not prone to fluctuate. Because if you call someone happy today and tomorrow he is sad, it diminishes the real significance of true happiness, giving happiness an unsecure base. It follows then that the only sure way to be happy is to stay on a constant path of virtuous life. There is no function of man that has much permanence as a virtuous activity, for there are more durable even than the knowledge of science. As such, when a person keeps the stability of practice of a life of virtue, he keeps a good character throughout, making him a happy person. Such a person will keep and continually study and live his life in accordance with virtue, engaged in virtuous actions and contemplations. He will be happy to bear fortunes and misfortunes in a steady manner, without faltering in any way, in any conditions at all. So that is what he says, that if this is supposed to be a factor, that happiness is something that doesn't have to fluctuate. It doesn't have to go up and down. Therefore, the only way we can define somebody happy is when they find that the person's life is over. So we can look back and say, Lawrence was a happy guy. Because he led his life constantly being in the virtuous activity. So that's how he talks about the first function of ego, which is the human function, backed by the reason power. Then he goes on in this second part to talk about another aspect that can help us to be happy. In this aspect, he calls it the doctrine of the me. So let's leave the first concept aside, and let's talk about the second aspect right now. This one he calls the doctrine of the me. And over here he says that for somebody to be happy, he must know this instrument. Because it's something that will help you to be able to distinguish what must I do? If I'm going to act, how should I act? Who can tell me that what I'm doing is right or wrong? How do I make my decisions in life? How do I know that what I'm doing is virtuous activity? And he says that, who is the authority to determine what is right or wrong? So Aristotle bases his ideas on what is called the doctrine of the me. And over here he says that there are two kinds of virtues, intellectual and moral. We learn intellectual virtues by instruction, and we learn moral virtues by habit and constant practice. We are all born with the potentials to be morally virtuous, but it's only by behaving the right way that we train ourselves to be virtuous people. As a musician learns to play an instrument, we learn virtue by practicing, not thinking about it. Up to this point, the argument, although coherent enough, is somehow thin. But what does acting in accordance with rationality mean? If we agree that the excellence of a human being consists in their carrying out well their unique function, and if we further agree that that function is indeed virtuous as Aristotle describes, are we any closer to understand how we ought to behave? To address this concern in Book 2, Aristotle introduces his most famous moral principle, the doctrine of the mean, which later became the doctrine of the golden mean, which in short explains that moral qualities are destroyed by defect and by excess. And good behavior consists in avoiding certain extremes. So the doctrine of the mean is therefore a principle that in effect amounts to a clear rule of behavior, a principle that involves, as he states, a mean which is relative to us. So for him, every human action comes along with excess and deficiency. Whatever you do could be an excess or could be a deficiency. So when you're about to act, the first thing you have to ask yourself, am I acting in an excess way or am I being deficient in my actions? He says that for you to be able to act well, you must find a mean. And the mean is what is called a moderation. And over here he talks about, for example, like foolhardiness and cowardice. These are the two extremes. So what do we say that what would be the best thing to do when somebody comes to this kind of situation? And you must come closer to the middle. And that is where you find courage. Licentiousness of insensibility. What would be the mean, or what would be the moderate concept in this particular situation will be what is called temperance. Extravagance and maybe stinginess, what would be the most important decision to make is to take the middle portion, which is called liberality. So for him, Aristotle never really, nobody was, he never really said that if we do this, this is right. But he leaves moral decisions, our actions into our own hands. So it's up to you to find the mean. It's up to you to find what is moderate. And for me, this makes it really interesting. And that is where, for him, human action is somehow very relative. He says it in his words. In the sense that it depends upon the circumstances that you find yourself. It depends upon the situation that you find yourself. And you use your reason power at a particular moment to make your own decisions. And that is where you can find what you call what is morbid. And when you find what is morbid, then you act on the morbid aspect of it all. And when you do that, then you are on the right path. You know, because like today, people may say, you have to base your action on the scriptures. You have to base your action maybe on the Quran, or you have to base your action on some doctrine or some dogma. For Aristotle, this doesn't have to be that way. All you have to do is to analyze the circumstances, analyze the situation, and always try to find what is the most important to do. So it's very, very subjective concept here. And it depends, and to be able to do this, it thinks that you have to use your own reason power. And that is why he said that if you don't apply reason, it's very difficult to be a virtuous person. So it goes on to say that, for example, as we see, Corinth, I've already described it, so I'll move on to some other things here. So he says that this meaning is not same for all men. However, the virtuous man must have the ability to know the best course for himself. This ability, Aristotle calls prudence. So for you to be able to know what kind of choice I should make, he calls it prudence. And prudence, or this concept of trying to determine the mean, relies on reason and understanding. And for this reason, the virtuous man must apply his senses. So if the person is able to make this distinction, be able to find this mean, then the person applies what we call the virtuous mean. And the virtuous mean is a disposition, not a feeling, not a faculty. Feelings are not subject of praise or blame, he says, as virtues and vices are. And while feelings move us to act in certain ways, virtues dispose us to act in another way altogether. Our faculties determine our capacity for feeling. And virtue is no more a capacity for feeling than it's feeling in itself. We can therefore define human virtue as a disposition to behave in the right manner and as a mean between extremes of deficiency and excess, which are vices. Of course, with some actions such as murder, adultery, there is no virtuous mean. Such of these actions are extremely wrong. That's what he says. That there are certain things that are intrinsically wrong. So those things like murder, adultery, whatever it is, it doesn't have to be applied by these kind of the virtue of the mean. So apart from this, any other human action that we go through must go through this kind of process. So before anybody acts, we have to go through this kind of process. Determining your actions before you make a choice. And if you make this constantly, every day in your life, then you become virtuous. And this is kind of difficult, but that is how, for him, a virtuous person tends us to be. So he talks about some extremes are closer to some. Sometimes you cannot really have a very, very distinct, clear-cut meaning in your decisions. But he leaves it to the human person himself to make these decisions for your own sake. So all that he's trying to say is that avoid excess and avoid deficiency. Try to look for the mean. Try to be moderate in your actions. Try to be moderate in your desires. Try to be moderate in whatever you do. And if you find this moderation, then you are on the right path. And he says over here, I quote, there is no universal rule, for example, about how much food an athlete should eat. And it will be absurd to infer from the fact that 10 ounces is too much or 2 ounces is too small. Therefore, I should eat 6 ounces of food. Finding the mean in any given situation is not a mathematical, or it's not a mechanical, or a thoughtless procedure, but requires a full and detailed acquaintance with reason and with circumstances. According to Aristotle, when the good person chooses to act graciously based on the mean, he does so for the sake of what he calls the kavod, a word that can mean beautiful and noble or refined. This you can see this in Book 5, Book 4, Chapter 1. Similarly, Aristotle holds that a word is a given human action that expresses the ethical virtues will not merely be advantageous, but it is beautiful in itself. So to act well by applying the doctrine of the mean, by applying your reason, by applying that kind of, you know, making the right choice for him is something noble and something beautiful. So the doctrine of the mean, according to Aristotle, helps us show what is attractive about virtue. And it also helps systematize our understanding of what are the qualities of virtues. Aristotle believes that a good person is someone who is good in deliberation, which is in effect a process of his rational enquiry. The intermediate point that a good person tries to find is determined by his reason, and in the same way that a person of practical reason will determine it. To say that a person sees what to do is simply a way of registering the point that the good person reasoning does succeed in discovering what is best in every situation. And because good people are so skilled at discovering the mean in difficult cases, we have to listen to those who are able to make this work for themselves. Therefore, we have to listen, we have to be educated. We have to ask people how to determine this concept of the mean. So far we're talking about the reason, talking about human function, talking about the doctrine of the mean. These things all are the mechanism that comes together to make a good action in life. For Aristotle, there is no possibility of writing a book of rules that will serve as a complete guide to wise decision making. And he goes on to say, So he goes on to say that, therefore Aristotle holds that ethics cannot be reduced to a system of rules, however complex, but he insists that some rules are inviolable. So it's a long thing. I was going to go about talking about practical wisdom, which is called the phrenesis. Over here, he talks about what he calls, reasoning all his principles one has at hand, having the ability to be able to do what is right. Over here, what we're supposed to do in our life, he calls the way the person is able to sit down, reflect, and make this kind of gradual decisions in his life to be able to be happy. And he goes on also to talk about the intellectual virtues, which I couldn't talk about, which is also about theoretical wisdom, called Sophia, talks about also intuitive understanding. And all these things come together for Aristotle, for the person to be able to make very interesting decisions in his life. Then he goes on to talk about the next slide, goes on to talk about what he calls the akrasia, which is also about, here he talks a lot about the human pathology called the pathos, emotions and feelings, which also comes into play when you want to talk about the human ways. He says that when you are emotional, when you have too much passion in you, sometimes this will block your reason power to help you make a better decisions in life. Then he goes also to talk about, for example, he talks about desire, that desire is the whole thing, where desire becomes the major concept upon which the person is being pushed to do what he does in his life. So in all, his overall argument is what I have here, that in human beings, every action, investigation, ends at some good. And the good that we are talking about, they all exist in hierarchy, And the lesser goods are instrumental in seeking what is the highest good. And number two, he talks about the highest good will be the final goal of purposeful striving. Something good in its own that will give you what you call the dharmia. And goes on talks about the goodness, including the human being that resides in our proper function, what we do in our lives that makes you happy, which is called the arete. Then he goes on talks about the proper function of every body, that you have to find what is your proper function, what is in you, what makes you are the way you are, and what will make you, know who you are. And from there, you can really know what you're supposed to do. Then the next slide, which is going to be the last one, is also talks about all kinds of things, including practical wisdom and intellectual behavior that I've talked about here. So now, to conclude, before we can go to the question time, Aristotle thinks that happiness is something that we are seeking in life. And everybody is in that direction. Because they tell us, the human being, that you have to do that. If you don't do these things by applying what he calls the instruments that will help you to become happy, you can never arrive there. So, after the first book, from book 2 to book 10, all that he talks about is the instruments that will make you a happy person. And he talks about all these things, intellectual virtues, practical wisdom. He talks about desire. He talks about fullnesses. He talks about the ergo, which is the human function. He talks about reason. He talks about the meaning, finding the meaning in the life. And when you're able to apply all these qualities, they help you to arrive at happiness. So he says the conclusion that happiness will never be a state, that it's an activity which you continue to do. So as you act, as you move on every day, acting in a virtuous way, you are doing the right thing. You are following that path towards happiness. But nobody knows, or maybe until you die, nobody can say that you are a happy person. So on this note, I think I will end my talk. I left so many things because it's so big, so beautiful, but I have to go faster and use so many things. But at the same time, that is the nutshell of the Nicomachean Ethics. That is what it talks about. So let's try and let's be happy.
There are hot hearing sections. You mentioned that Aristotle used the word eudaimonia,
yes,
which comes from the self-sufficiency of the divine. You know, and with a connotation that was contrary to the traditional meaning. What led to using the word that way? You
know? Yeah, it's actually, he just, you know, because he said that eudaimonia means that being the state being fulfilled by the gods. That is really the real meaning. But he thought to be happy is not being a favor. But you know, that word was so popular at that time. So anybody who was happy was considered to be in the harmony, near state. You know? But for him, that definition was faulty. Because for him, there is nothing like being blessed, being a blissful state. He doesn't believe in that. So he reinterpreted that kind of word. He gave it a new meaning altogether. That, no, wait a minute, to be happy doesn't mean that you're being blessed by some God. But happiness means it's work. It's a lot of work. It's called the nice part of the venture activity. It's a constant daily work which you have to do. And that is where I see Plato and Aristotle, that's where the whole thing begins. Because Plato will say, okay, when you are able to, you know, you're not yourself. Your real self is up there. You are just here representing something else. Therefore, it's different. But for Aristotle, he said, you are here. That is why he puts his hand on the ground by saying that you are here. And whatever you do here is very, very important. So he was so pragmatic. You know. So he was able to redefine eudaimonia to mean that it's a state that has to be achieved individually. But it has to be done with a lot of work. And that's why he said that when you get certain levels and you think you are happy, that is wrong. But when you get money, you think that is all. That is wrong. And that's why you have to move on. You have to get to that level which you call the altakeia, which is mean that when you get to that level, you are self-sufficient. You don't need anything. And that is the highest point. But he was confused by saying, okay, can you attain that goodness on this planet or something after you die? Then he goes back to confuse us and himself by saying, okay, it's only when you die that we can say you are happy, because happiness doesn't operate at all. So he redefined that word in Armenia, but original meaning was not that, you know, what he said. This year.
Do we know whether or not Aristotle died happy?
Nobody talks about his life, because he got married, he got a second wife, Pythias was his first wife, he married, he got a second wife, and he had a son. And his life was very, very, he moved from one place to another, you know. And that is when, finally...
So we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. Nobody says about whether he...
Did he get a father's statement?
No, he doesn't really say. Apart from the Nicomachean ethics, he doesn't really say whether he was happy before he died. He never really... He was sick, had a short illness, and he just passed away. That's not the history of the Bible.
So there's no final statement?
No, there was nothing concrete that you say that I am dying and I think I have arrived. Yes, that pyramid doesn't really show up in any of his writings. But he led on this kind of way. Yes, sir.
In his whole ethics, it's not for him or the person himself to say whether one is happy.
Yes,
it's for
society.
Others,
yes.
For the society,
yes,
to determine whether he's happy or not.
Yes,
so based on that, though, given all the history about him, would you say that he was happy?
Maybe, because my conclusion, the other part of it was going to talk about finding happiness in the society, you know. He said that you can never attain happiness on your own. It has to be something communal, it has to be something participatory. It has to be something done in together. Therefore, in his Politics, chapter 1, he talks about nobody can be a human being without living on an island or being, you know, disconnected. You can never attain happiness in your life. Therefore, happiness is something that has to be, you know, attained in society. And society has its principles that you have to follow. And the pursuance of good is something which is more communal, that we are all moving towards that kind of end. So when, that's why he talks about political science as being a very instrumental factor in finding happiness, because political science will form the individual. Individually, but at the same time too, for the common good. Therefore, as we are being formed individually, we pursue the same goal. And that is something beautiful. So for him, he thinks that we can all move towards this happiness in society. But in an individual way, we have it in our own way. But at the same time too, it's something that has to be done together. Me, you, all of us, in the same direction. That is the telos. Yes, sir?
I was wondering about So I understand that, you know, we think of Aristotle as being a scientist and a naturalist, Plato as being a mystic and a mythicist.
Mm-hmm.
But Plato's good. Our thing is it's the thing in itself that performs ultimately in this being when they're stripped of all their persons. And that seemed like an assumption in the most Jewish purpose.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm looking at that side there and I think, wow, well, in this sense, Aristotle's not that far off. Is it the same good?
Yes, you're right. Yeah, because when you read book 10, he comes to the concept of happiness will finally end up in contemplation. That's what he says. You know? And he, in a way, he enters into Platonic concept of, you know, something that is up there. And he even says that one of the happiest guy should be a philosopher. That makes me a little bit good, feel good, guys. He said, the philosopher is happier than the political scientist because he thinks, he meditates, he thinks about things. Exactly. And that's why he said that intellectual virtue, for example, it's amazing because for him, he who thinks, he who reflects, he who uses the mind, rationality inside his mind and philosophizes, is the person who is happier than the one who uses practical wisdom.
That's what I thought was a real difference between the contemplation. I mean, I've heard different interpretations.
Yeah.
But it seemed like it's the contemplation of a higher idea.
Yes, yeah. But he says that despite the fact that you end up in contemplation, it's not a one-day job. I mean, you have to lead a virtuous life.
Right.
So when you lead a virtuous life, backed by the human function, but by practical wisdom, which is the phronesis, you become a phronimos, you know, and becoming alert, excellence in your virtues, and you having that concept of, you know, using your intellectual virtues, all these things coming together, then you get onto that track. And when you move on, then you end up in that contemplation.
And that is where you end up in happiness. And that's why he said that it involves your whole life, you know. It begins right from your infancy and backed by society, external factors, you know, different kinds of ideas and different kinds of ways of life that you go through. All these things build you up. But very, very importantly, the ergo, which is the human function, the doctrine of the me that will help you find the right decision that you have to make, your intellectual virtues and your practical wisdom, desire, these things are very important, and the control of your emotions. These things are the fundamental factors that you need to have as tools that will guide you towards the highest good. Because when you get to a certain level, you think you are happy, think about it, reflect about it, and don't just stop there. You have to move on because you are not yet there. That's what he thinks. So he really gets into Plato, but he backs out and, you know, affirms his practical lifestyle. So, yeah. Any other question? Yes, sir.
I'm interested to know about the influence of society and culture. It seems to me that there's a little inconsistency here.
Yes.
Because, you know, if you're living within the rules that society makes of your culture, okay, those rules may not be
conducive to
your track.
You're right.
Okay, so how do we
answer? Yeah, because if you read his politics, he talks about what are the important rules and regulations that we have to, you know, apply. And that is why he talks about, even in the society, the doctrine of the mean is very important. See? And he even says that certain things like adultery, these things are intrinsically wrong. Therefore, for him, number one is that the common good is important. But at the same time too, the individuals must find a way of determining their own good. You know? So the society is there. And for the society will never make rules for you. But the person must have the good sense of making the right choice. He thinks that when you apply the doctrine of the mean, for example, he thinks you will get it right. He thinks it's highly impossible to go wrong if you really apply the doctrine of the mean very well by finding, don't go to the excess and don't go to the defeat, don't go to that kind of, you know, being lacking, but find the moderation. Moderation in life is the key. So if you know how to find moderation in life, if he knows, if I know, in a way we are all together, you know, and backed by the reason, the rationality, that's the only thing we say that it's only the human being who can be happy, because there's one thing that we all share in this room is our reason. So why can't we come together? And that is for me, that's one of my personal problems about today, ethics in this world of today, where we can never find common grounds in any way. It's sad. It's very subjective. Somehow it's very relative as well, in the way that everybody defines things in his own way. You know. How do we come together and find some basics, some fundamental qualities that can really guide humanity towards what is good, which is lacking. In my research, in my studies, it's been one of my greatest disappointments. I never came across anything. Everybody comes up with different ideas, and there's no way, why can't we sit down as one people and get certain things right? And that is why people like Hugo Grotius and Francisco Suarez, all these people, one thing they said that we can't be united if we use this. That's the only thing that binds us all together. Different colors, different races, different traditions, different countries. We are different from different continents. But there's one thing that connects all humanity, and that is our race of power. So we as human beings, are we failing? What are we doing that we can come together and use these functions to determine what is good for mankind and make it a way to educate our children to follow that kind of path? I don't know. Maybe, yes?
I was just going to say, it seems like, you know, as soon as a child is born, he becomes socialized.
Yes.
You know, socialization forms him, whatever way, just in his mind and their capacity to think and research. Systematically subjugated
yeah.
to the desires of the culture.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Don't read the man-made.
Yes.
I mean, there are some cultures where it doesn't exist. People in that culture decided that it doesn't exist.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
You know,
I mean,
it would seem to me, and I'm sure everybody's as tight as they can be, but it would seem to me that if we just kept it really simple, that we might, if we started somewhere that's really simple,
and just move on.
Nothing's intrinsic, except maybe killing people.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, we're right. You know, that could be one of the basic factors that we can start from. And that is where people, many philosophers have talked about it. But at the same time, too, it's not very easy. And Aristotle talks about desire, for example, that emotions and all these things, it comes into play. And people, he talks about akrasia and kritia. People that have good thinking, good mind, they have good intentions, but they never get it right. Because the moment they decide on something, they want to act, emotions takes over, and they do the wrong thing. And he talks about the danger of those people. And for him, these are the factors which we have to begin to think about. And at the end of my conclusion, I was going to talk about education, for example, which for him, he mentions in the Nicomachean, and it's very, very important that right from the beginning, teach the child how to make a distinction, how to make what it is to become virtuous. Your life. So it's true, but the world is changing, and I don't know where the answers will be. Maybe someday. Yes?
I'm sure you've read the studies of the countries in the world that are the happiest countries.
The happiest countries in the world? I don't know. I lived in Europe for a long time, I lived in most of the countries in Europe for some time now, and I don't know. The place that, yes sir.
The happiest countries by a recent survey of Scandinavia.
Yes, and maybe I heard that, but I don't know whether, they determine that kind of happiness. I know, they determine that kind of happiness based on maybe society and
North America, it's considered between Canada and Costa Rica.
Yes, I see, but those are the modern way of defining, but when you go back to our Australian concept of happiness, it's totally different approach altogether. It's totally a different approach altogether. And that is how I expect. You are right. And most of the countries that I've been to, I don't know. It's so difficult, But I lived in Iceland for about 8 months. I was doing a research, and then something struck me about the people over there, even though it's very cold, it's very cold and very chilly. But I found them to be very warm people. Iceland. And I had to study the language and do some research, and I found it really interesting, And it really struck me a lot, And sometimes that is how it is. I don't know. Yeah.
Can you comment on the modern, current thing in the news is the Pope's recent comments on the use of condoms and AIDS. Since he was one of your former employers, I Aristotle would have to say today in terms of let's look at the back.
Actually, it's true because I lived in Rome for like 14 years, and to tell the truth, I was just in my house where I live was just at the back of the Vatican. So I walked to the Vatican every morning to school and back, And that's like, this is church stuff, I don't know what. But I think Pope John Paul II has been criticized heavily in Africa because people think Pope John Paul II was one of the causes that HIV/AIDS has spread to an unimaginable situation in Africa, because he preached that you can't use the condom, the contraception, and most people. Between 2000 and 2002, I left my studies in Rome and went back to Ghana, my country, to do 2 years of voluntary work, and I was working with the HIV/AIDS patients, I was living in the bush, in the forest, and we were educating them and giving them instructions how to, and we had a big issue on the condom thing. They wouldn't take it at all because the Pope says no. So a man will contract the HIV, and he has three or four wives, and they all get HIV, and within a few years, they die. And you wouldn't imagine how many orphans that we have in my own country today. and a kid who comes from that kind of background, nobody wants that child. So people have criticized Pope John Paul a lot on this issue. And when I heard on the TV two days ago that he says in his new book, which is coming out, which is called The Light of the World, it's a new book which is coming out, he gives a new opening, a new approach by saying there's a little bit that if you know that you are in that circumstances, then to prevent a disease from spreading, then you can use the condom. But that has been our main subject back in Africa. But it never really worked until now. So we hope it's gonna really change a little bit.
Last question, Barbara.
Yes.
Okay.
Typically on the condom issue, it is the way the Pope looks at it, it's a greater sin to pass HIV on to other people than it is to stop procreating. He still doesn't condone the condoms, but only in that one situation.
Yeah.
My question to you is, in light of the golden age, the meeting between extremes, really not too much,
not too little.
Therefore, how would you differentiate between temperance and abstinence?
It depends, you know, it's a quick question. As I also say, it's very relative. And it's circumstantial. So I cannot really give a specific position. It's like two extreme ends, you know, and you are there. So you have to find where you think, but that meaning depends upon you. It's very relative and it depends upon the circumstances. That's what he says. Therefore, for him, even, he never really gave, he says, for example, with cowardice and courage, sometimes the mean will sway from one section to the another, because most people would love to be coward than to be more, you know, rash in their deliberation, in their actions. Therefore, it's very, very, very relative, you know. But he says that, I understand that, but for that one, I cannot give a specific answer because that is what he says. And in my own way, I think Aristotle, George,
he would go with temperance.
That's true. Yeah, he could. But you know, he dodged the question by saying, he dodged that kind of problem by saying that you decide, circumstance and subjective up to you. Find it and use your reason. Consider, contemplate, and find the solutions to what your decision will be. Yes, sir.
Okay, well.